Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club. It's a special podcast, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. And we get into a little bit more conversation with our featured authors who are in the Radio Book Club. This month, we're talking with Scott Carney, and his latest book is What Doesn't Kill Us: How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. One of the areas I was fascinated by in the book was this new, maybe it's not that new, well, I guess it's kind of emerging, obstacle course races or OCRs, which are becoming incredibly popular. And you go back to the kind of originator of this, the original race in England, but they've become this huge franchise and big money-making thing. Weekend warriors heading up to the mountains here in Colorado. First of all, what is an obstacle course race and why are they becoming so popular?
Well, they're one of these like really tremendously fun events where you end up suffering for 2.5 hours, jumping over walls, climbing under barbed wire, getting shocked by electrical things, you know, all, you know, maybe crawling through mud, maybe jumping over fire, you know, all of these things that in general you don't think you want to do. But people love doing it, and it's crazy. Like, it's like, I don't have know the exact figures off the top of my head, but we're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being earned by various companies doing this, and they're selling suffering essentially. And I think part of it's because we live in these such comfortable lives that we feel like we have this maybe underlying urge to know what we're capable of. Maybe it's sort of this macho thing to sort of, you know, have a rite of passage. Maybe it's just because, like, hell, I'm sitting in an office all day. Wouldn't it be nice if I could, you know, do something cool? And then it also plays really well on Facebook. Like, Spartan Race has photographers at every 10 feet taking pictures of you where they have RFID chips that automatically tag it so that you can immediately have that photo, that badass photo of you looking so much more badass than your other friend is just on their cell phone checking their updates. But for me, you know, I wanted to see if this training that I've been doing worked, you know, and I wanted a challenge to do it. And the OCRs seem like the obvious place to try a little bit of suffering and try to see if I'd been able to do anything to my body.
Well, you did one in Vail, and I think your wife very courageously
was it Breck?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, somewhere up in the mountains in Colorado, she accompanied you. But and then there are more and more women doing this, and we'll get into that in a minute. But did you dislocate your hip or your leg in the process of this? Something popped out.
Yeah, it popped out and it popped back in. I don't think it had to do with the training. I think you know, it had this like sort of nasty sound, and I was like, oh, that's bad. It turned out I was fine in the end. I just was sore most of the day. So,
but people are breaking fingers and dislocating things and breaking ribs and
dying in some cases.
It's big, big cuts and scratches and bruises. And
I don't know, they're great.
I mean, well, one thing, okay, well, one thing you mentioned, the kind of this macho thing sometimes goes on, and the book has, I was wondering almost like, what if this had been written by a woman who had gone to Wim Hof and a woman who was experiencing it? Would that be a different book? Is this really kind of, is there a macho culture somewhat ingrained in this? You know, there's this competition, there's this, we're going to go to the very edge, you know?
Funny you should mention what would happen if a woman had written this, because there actually was a book written by a woman who did one of the Kilimanjaro expeditions with Wim, I think a year before I did. Maybe it was 2 years before. And it's only out in Dutch, but the translation is Kilimanjaro as Medicine was the title she chose. And I can't read it because it's in Dutch. But one of the things which I think is one of the bigger detractions from the way the Wim Hof method is presented is that it does seem very macho. And there is this sort of macho culture that can emerge from, hey, I can go stay in ice water longer than you, or look how long I can hold my breath. And that's not super appealing to me because I don't feel like I'm a super macho guy. And I think it can push women away because who wants to be around all the dudes doing the dude things, right? But that is changing because first of all, we're having more and more women instructors of the method showing up. And there's actually one over on Tennyson Street here in Denver. And her name's Ely, and you could go take a training with an actual woman who's doing this stuff. And there's, you know, anyone can suffer from an autoimmune illness. Anyone can struggle with their weight. Anyone can want to be more in touch with their bodies. So there's clearly benefits to that. But I do want to see this become more inclusive from the get-go versus just being this sort of macho endeavor. Because, you know, as I make the point over and over in the book, I am not a super athlete. I am not this super macho dude, although I can sort of take a good shirtless photo every now and then, right? But I think that culture was just naturally changed. I think initially it certainly appealed to men. Look at OCRs, for instance. When those started, we're talking 90% male participation. But now it's almost egalitarian. It's like 40-60 right now. So, you know, these cultures can change. And, you know, if the first adopters were men, so be it. I think that anyone can see the joy in that, right? I mean, have you done any OCRs lately?
I have never done an OCR. I'm being honest, I'm not that inclined to do one.
But I'm not either. So
but you at least rolled around in the snow shirtless.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty good with the cold. We were just talking about that before we came in. I mean, I like to walk. I do lots of walks all year round. You know, even if it's 0 degrees, I get my daily walk in every day. I mean, I'm bundled up. I'm not shirtless. But so that... I was a little hesitant to do that with Scott. I rolled around in the snow with Scott outside of Boulder Bookstore, but I thought it's only going to be a couple minutes.
But you have a smile on your face. We will post a photo on our website, but there is a smile on your face. I mean, what was happening to you physiologically?
Not as much as I expected. Like, I was more tensed up. It's going to be really cold. It was like 10 degrees that day. But then when I actually laid down in the snow next to Scott, I didn't want to put my head down. That's true. But when my back was in the snow, it was almost insulated. There was an initial second of cold, but then like my back, my body heat and the snow somehow formed something that I wasn't super cold. You know, I mean, I was surprised. I got a little more cold when I got up from the snow and then the air hit my wet back.
And what about when you were warming up? Because that's something that you write about, Scott, that often the pain that maybe we think will happen when we're exposed to extreme cold doesn't necessarily happen when we're in the cold. It's when we're in the warming up process that can actually be quite painful.
Well, it's both. I mean, initially when you put your body in the snow, you'll have something called vasoconstriction, which is where the arteries in your body will constrict to keep the blood to your core. And if you never exercise those muscles, that's going to hurt. And that's just the way it's going to be. But vasodilation, the inverse process where those muscles relax, can also be painful because then these muscles relax and then warm blood moves through cold tissues. And that can be painful, but it can also give you something called after drop, which is where you have to be more cold than us, but we did.
Right, we were only out there for 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, it was nothing. And
I wouldn't say it was nothing.
but if you got pretty cold, right? If you're hanging out, if you do the polar bear plunge instead of just running out, you actually stood, you know, hung out in the water for like 5 minutes, you might have this experience where you start shivering a lot. Because what's going to happen is those extremities, which when you were trying to preserve your heat by you know, putting all the blood in your core, are now at a lower temperature. And when they dilate, the arteries dilate, blood will recirculate through a cold place and then return cold blood to your core. So then you can get these shivering, sort of difficult to heat up thing.
In extreme cases, people can die.
Yeah, right? That's usually how you die of hypothermia. Well, no, there's two ways. It's usually how people die in like EMT situations for hypothermia. It's just why if you are severely hypothermic, you want to go take a hot shower, but you should not take a hot shower. You should take a cold shower because that's, you know, if the water is like 60 coming out of the faucet or 40 or whatever, that's still warmer than what your limbs are. And so you want to warm up slowly in those situations. I did have after drop, I think, twice on this trip, and it can be dangerous, but you can also modulate it. Like you can, one thing you might be able to do is if you're experiencing after drop, start doing a cardio exercise like push-ups or sit-ups or something like that. So then you're going to be generating muscle energy versus just like shivering yourself warm. So that's one thing you can do. The breathing method may also help. But it is something to be aware of if you start getting involved in this training a lot, that you know you're not immune to the elements. You're expanding your ability to resist them. But in the end, in the battle of you versus nature, I'm going to always wager on nature.
And what about frostbite? Because that's an issue as well. You know, your body naturally withdraws all the necessary components to the core, I think, when you're exposed to an extreme condition. So, I mean, is frostbite an issue, or is that something that can be overcome with this method as well?
I mean, you have to be aware of these dangers. I mean, the thing is, you're fighting two things. One is your mind being like, oh my God, it hurts, I'm gonna die, right? And so you need to get over that because your mind's wrong. On the other hand, there's like, nature can kill me, right? And so you have to sort of modulate between where your brain thinks is comfortable and what is actually dangerous. So I have a frostbite table in my book. I've learned that that table is not necessarily accurate. You know, I found that I've been in colder environments for longer than where that number is. But I think it has to do with a lot of things, right? Like if I'm generating body heat and then I'm circulating that warm blood through my extremities, it's going to be more resistant to frostbite than somebody whose extremities are then already cold and then are getting buffeted by wind. So there's it's this whole conversation really between the environment and you as you do it. But I never came down with frostbite, although I did do this one thing. Sometimes I'll go shovel my snow I live in Denver. So sometimes I'll go shovel my snow and, you know, the walkway and things like that. And I'll just be wearing shorts, so barefoot onto the pavement and the snow as I do it. And I actually got frost nip doing this, which was unexpected to me because...
What's frost nip?
Frost nip is like pre-frostbite, like frostbite's younger and like wimpier brother. And what that does is the nerves sort of remember the pain. And so then it sort of like hurts on the skin for about a week afterwards. It's not great. I'm sure it's damage. And I was a little shocked because I'm actually very good in dealing with sort of those extreme cold. It didn't really hurt while I was doing it. I was like, oh, look, maybe I pushed myself in a way that I should have been a little bit more careful with. And I think the real issue there was that because my feet were directly on pavement, which also had salt on it. I think that the pavement was actually colder than the snow. And so it was just a little unexpected. So you know, it's this is why with the training, I think it's smart to take things sort of slowly. And I don't think getting frostbite is necessarily bad, like, you know, a week of like moderate pain to learn that maybe you should do that in a slightly different way. That's a great lesson, and that you're listening to your body. But, you know, toes start turning black and purple. Yeah, we're in a big problem here.
So in the book, you present these profiles of a lot of different people, whether they're people from OCR races or whether they're Wim Hof or, you know, these different people who are dealing with diseases. And they're mostly positive, right, to even keel. But the one person who I thought didn't come off well in the book was Orlando Bloom. And I thought maybe you could tell us, you know, what's up with Orlando and why does he do this to himself?
Yeah, well, that was the chapter with Laird Hamilton, who's like the world's most famous surfer, you know, surfed the heaviest, biggest, baddest, assest wave in the world. And so he runs this training camp up in Malibu in Los Angeles, right north of Los Angeles. And it's like the celebrity workout. Like you go there and it's just like filled with celebrities and like famous-ish people. Rick Rubin works out there. Orlando Bloom works out there. John McGinley works out there. His wife, Gabrielle Reese, works out there. I mean, there's a ton of people who go there. So I show up and Laird's techniques are based in part on Wim's breathing techniques. He also does ice baths and things like that. And then he adds sort of this underwater weight routine, which... where he doesn't do the hyperventilation while doing that. He does some sort of different stuff, but you get into the book to see exactly what that's about. But then Orlando, who's there when I show up, and I actually have like a sauna with him, an hour sauna experience with Orlando Bloom, which was sort of funny. But what he's known for is, in that group is something called Bloomouts, where he will work so hard doing this, doing these sort of underwater breath hold exercises that he'll pass out.
And in the water.
In the water, which can lead to something called drowning. It's a clinical condition where you die. And so they're always like having to rescue Orlando from what they say is going floppy. So this is actually the reason, the main reason why there's this warning on the front page of the book is that there are things in here that you should not do, which is drowning. You shouldn't do the breathing method, hyperventilate, and then go into the water because there's this chance that you pass out. And that's just sort of one of the things that one of the risks that you run in this sort of training. And you can sort of learn where those rough edges of where passing out might happen are after you do more and more of it, but you'll never know for certain. And so if you tried to mix this with, say, free diving, that consequences are not good. I think we've had 3 deaths in the Wim Hof method, and they're all due to drowning. Uh-huh. So Orlando, I think, is maybe a little safer because he's also doing this right in front of Laird Hamilton, who is like the world's best swimmer, a water guy.
He's like Aquaman.
Phelps. Yeah. Phelps is probably the world's best swimmer, but you know, Laird is pretty amazing. So he's doing this in a way where he's being rescued, but I don't think I don't think they like it.
But why is he doing it? Because, I mean, obviously, Laird Hamilton and his wife, they're, you know, extreme athletes. Mm-hmm. Is it, like, back to that macho thing? Is it Orlando Blue wants to be an extreme athlete? Does he have chronic cold sores like you? I mean, why would he be doing this?
So the way they I didn't really interrogate him too much on that. I
was in the sauna.
You're trying to get him to play you in the movie, right?
No, I think I'm Ryan Gosling, if I had to choose. But, you know, with Orlando, the way they explained it, and I don't know if this is legit, but what they say is that Orlando was originally trained as a Shakespearean actor, you understand, on the stages in England. And he learned to recite whole passages of Shakespeare with such eloquence and at such extended times on a single breath that he has tremendous breath control. This is like what they tell me, right? And so because of that, he has this tremendous ability, and that when he's in the water, he transfers it there and sometimes pushes himself to the utmost. I don't know. I mean, he just pushes himself too far, and don't do that.
But it's a workout. I mean, that's why they're all over at Laird Hamilton's very deep swimming pool.
Yes, exactly. And you know, some people have that personality where they want to push their absolute limits. And, you know, I can't tell you what quirk, but I think he's probably under more pressure than other people, right? He's on screen all the time. And like, if you remember the memes that went around Lord of the Rings, that everyone's like, oh, look, wimpy Orlando Bloom, girly man. They're all saying that about him, right? And that's sad. I mean, can you imagine having the whole world saying this about you? So actually, when I met him, dude, guy was built. I mean, like, so I'm shirtless and he's got huge muscles, and I'm sure he's like taken that to the heart. He's like, I'm going to be a big man. And he is he is not a girly man. He's a very serious trainer. So I think there's some sort of conversation with the broader internet sphere of like hate that is making him push himself.
Well, it's almost like a body image. You know, we had a woman on a couple months ago who wrote a whole book. It was a novel, but it was a book about women's body image and how she always saw herself as fat, even when she had totally thinned down. Mm-hmm. And what that body image, once it's internalized, it can make you do some things that maybe you wouldn't otherwise do.
Sure.
And so that could have been more damaging than we can know.
Yeah. And, you know, he's in front of hundreds of millions of people probably, right? So whatever pressures he has is very different than mine or anyone else's. Like, I don't feel like I need to prove myself. But then again, I don't have millions of people telling me, you know, look buffer or whatever it is, you know? That's not one of my problems, thankfully, very much. On the other hand, Orlando Bloom has a tremendous amount more money than I do and access and power. So maybe trade-off is even, right?
Well, for people who are listening who are, you know, maybe a little bit intrigued by this, don't necessarily want to go straight in and do the full training. I mean, how can you dip your toe into the icy waters of this? Like, quick cold shower in the morning is going to just benefit everyone? Or how can you just slightly participate?
You know, I have a 15-minute outline for this in my book, and you really need to do both. Don't, the cold showers alone will do something for you, but they will not, you will get so much more out of doing both the breathing method for 15, actually today it was 12 minutes is all I had to do today for the breathing, and the cold shower. And those two in conversation have a real beneficial impact.
And you do the breathing before the shower?
I do the breathing before the shower, yeah, before you eat breakfast. You just do it on an empty stomach. And, you know, it's 15 minutes of hyperventilation, then breath out, breath holds, one recovery breath for about 15 seconds, and then repeat the cycle. Do that three times, then do a fourth breathing and each time you should hold your breath longer. You can have a timer with you as you do it. You know, iPhone has it. And then at the end, you do some push-ups. And then I throw in a headstand and some, like, basic yoga poses, whatever you want. You know, at that point, it doesn't really matter. And then you go into your shower, you soap up, you wash off, and then you finish it with cold, maybe 30 seconds at first. And this is the hardest thing, you know, saying to you earlier today.
Yes, I have my hand on the knob, but I can't do it.
Yeah, it's the hardest thing a human can do, I'm pretty sure, is go from comfortable warm shower into cold shower. But you got to do it and suck it up and turn that knob all the way down. And I measured the water temperature of the faucet water in Denver, and it was, a warm 42. So it's not really that bad. And you can sit there, and instead of tensing up, this is key, this is critical, instead of being like, oh my God, it hurts and everything gets so tight, you don't do that. That response may happen initially, but you're not done until you can relax in it and just say, hey, it's not so bad, and like really, really relax. And that is essential. It's really the same skill as you're having at the end of a breath hold where you want to gasp, but you're sort of holding it back. That's like the tense side of things. And in the ice, you're trying to do this, the parasympathetic side, the relaxing side, and by doing these two things together, you gain a lot of control over your nervous system.
And it sounds like you get pretty immediate results. I mean, certainly when you went to Poland to Wim Hof's camp, I mean, it took you a week or even a couple of days before you started noticing a difference.
I mean, you take a cold shower right now, right? You go home and you just turn it cold and stay there for 2 minutes, which is actually a little bit long at first, but whatever. Do it for 2 minutes. I promise you won't die, right? At the end of that, you will feel warm, because your body's like, oh my God, and it's been doing these things to heat itself up, and you're going to go from a really cold environment to a less cold environment, and you'll feel warm. And you may also feel like a general like endorphin, good feeling-y rush that comes after it. You'll get much more of those feelings after you do the breathing, because you have this sort of glow after that. You sort of have this very sort of nice, relaxed feeling after both. And it's because you're playing with your autonomic systems and you're directly targeting autonomic responses as you do this stuff.
I'm going to get right on that.
Okay, I look forward to hearing how glowing you are.
We'll give a report next month. Well, in the meantime, Scott Carney, thank you so much. His latest book is What Doesn't Kill Us: How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for having me on.